This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Good day all, Brad Dearborn here. Today we're going to spend the next hour looking inside the March-April of 2024 edition of Wired Magazine. Now, I will point out that this is the UK edition, but a lot of this content is pretty darn international. So, let's get down to business. And we start today with the editor's essay. I write this the day after the UK Foreign Secretary, former Prime Minister David Cameron, stated that, quote, "the lights are flashing red," end quote, on the global dashboard. It's mid-January and the news cycle is once again in overdrive with what feels like a relentlessly bleak news fire hose. Whether that's the continuing conflict in Ukraine or in the Gaza Strip or the data points on ice coverage of lakes in North America, even Iceland's volcanoes have turned red. Cameron's statement was a reference to the possibility of the escalation of a regional conflict in the Middle East involving Western forces and Iranian proxies. And, with a gloomy global economic outlook, inflation not yet under control, populists gaining traction in democracies from Europe to Asia, not to mention the prospect of a second Trump term, and the Chinese economy cooling, 2024 appears to look something like a slog. And let's not get into some of the data related to global heating or biodiversity loss. Prime Minister Harold Macmillan, when asked what the greatest challenge of leadership is, reputedly replied, "Events, dear boy, events." This, of course, has always been the case, but the interconnected nature of the world and the disruptions in the form of disinformation, populist leaders, climate breakdown, inequality, conflict, and a growing sense that the institutions created after the Second World War are no longer fit for purpose. All of this has created a sense of there being a growing disaster. Constantly responding to crises means that it's tough for leaders to stay on top of the moment. By the time one challenge is dealt with, integrate generative AI into your business now, quantum computing will make your corporate security obsolete, you've just finished your carbon output audit. Now what about your biodiversity policy? Well, after all that, something else appears. This constant game of whack-a-mole is why CEOs are paid so handsomely. But although they may prove competent at navigating treacherous waters, the cut and thrust of the day-to-day skirmishes detracts from one of the most important aspects of their roles, long-term thinking. Volatility and uncertainty mean a focus on short-term resilience, and the most significant challenges all require long-term strategic thinking. While leaders are focused on crises, they have less time to consider the opportunities of the disruption they're facing, which has a negative effect on business performance. Leaders ignore election cycles and earnings reports at their peril. At the UK Conservative Party conference this year, Prime Minister Rishi Sunak made the case that he was a leader focused on long-term decision-making. The following week, Sir Keir Starmer, the Labour Party leader, told delegates that his vision for the country could only be delivered with a Labour government that wins two consecutive terms. Whatever the merits of their claims, it's clear that the key responsibilities that large organizations face cannot be addressed in the short term. Aside from growth and operating profit, societal, governance and environmental considerations are increasingly linked to strong corporate performance and market relevance in an environment where organizations are increasingly held to higher standards than in the past. The challenge for executives is that they are usually judged based on what has just happened. The successful organizations and governments of the future will be able to effectively articulate and communicate long-term plan which will excite the investors and galvanize the workforce. This, of course, applies to the government, too. Crucially, strategic vision shouldn't be set and then remain static. Orientation of companies and countries needs to be an ongoing process. This approach will often lead to significant shifts in strategy in response to external forces. Leaders need to consider strategy to be continual, not an event in itself. And first up, we see an article under this title, Human Scale. These nightmarish mannequins undergo daily torture at the hands of textile scientists. But their suffering means we humans on our warming planet can have future-proofed clothing capable of handling the heat. Meet Andy, the world's sweatiest mannequin. Although he might look like a shop floor stalwart from a distance, a closer glance reveals bundles of cabling and pipework concealed beneath his shell. He's wired up with sensors, plumbed into a liquid supply, and dotted with up to 150 individual pores that open when he gets warm. It sounds kind of gross, but it's all by design. Andy is a sophisticated, breathing, walking, and yes, perspiring mannequin, part of a range of body analog dummies developed by Seattle-based firm Thermetrics. He made headlines recently, in mannequin circles at least, because researchers at Arizona State University are using an Andy model to study how the human body reacts to extreme heat. 2023 was the hottest since records began, and as the world gets warmer, clothing designers, car manufacturers, and militaries are among organizations scrambling to develop technology that's fit for purpose, whether it's more breathable textiles or novel cooling solutions. People are everywhere, and there's billions of dollars in capital trying to figure out how to keep people safe, comfortable, and fashionable. And all those things have a link to the human thermal environment, says Rick Burke, president and engineering manager of Thermetrics, who has been with the company for 33 of its 35 years. The easiest way to test that gear would be put to a human in it and ask them how they feel. But that also has its drawbacks. Human test subjects are super expensive and super subjective, says Burke, and they tend not to like it when you set them on fire. So, from the 1940s onward, the U.S. military began building the first thermal mannequins, human-shaped heaters to test garments for soldiers. Say the Army is sending its forces somewhere cold, and they need to know how many layers to send with each soldier. If clothing can be optimized for the specific deployment environment, lower costs and safer soldiers clearly justifies the testing investment, says Burke. The technology evolved in the 1980s and 90s as sportswear manufacturers began using it to put new products through their paces. While the addition of more individual heating zones to the mannequins added further realism. Recent developments include internal cooling and Andy's modified sweating function, which can be paired with a computer simulation of human physiology to mimic the body's attempt to heat and cool itself. Our mannequins are just a shell. They don't have meat, says Burke. But we have a virtual simulation of the meat. As well as Andy, who is based on the average male body shape, Thermetrics makes dozens of other products, including a female thermal mannequin called Liz, a baby thermal mannequin called Ruth. That's also one of the creepiest things you'll ever see. And Stan, a sweating simulacra backside designed for automakers to test heated and ventilated car seats. Roam around the Thermetrics lab and you'll also see disembodied hands, feet, faces, and arms. Mannequins can also be dressed in protective clothing and then ignited in a fire chamber to see how well the garments perform. In Arizona, researchers are using Andy to understand the limits of the body. We're able to push the mannequin to core temperatures that we wouldn't do with humans, or we can try to understand why somebody got heat stroke by replicating the scenario to see what happened, explains Conrad Rykaczewski, an associate professor at ASU, which is based in Phoenix, where daytime temperatures can exceed 43 degrees Celsius in the summer months. I'll do the conversion for you. That's 109.4 degrees Fahrenheit. Thermal mannequins can also be used to test cooling strategies, modeling more efficient methods by directing airflow to where it will have the biggest effect, for instance. In Phoenix, a recent Cool Pavements pilot program applied a reflective coating to street surfaces so heat isn't absorbed by the dark asphalt. We could put Andy on one of these cool pavements and see what happens, says Ariane Middell, an associate professor at ASU. Is he going to feel hotter? Is he going to feel cooler? Is he going to sweat more? As the world heats up, those are questions we're all going to want the answers to. And we move along to the next article. This one has a headline that reads, "A therapy based on picking up good vibrations." Parkinson's patients can improve mobility and reduce tremors by feeling rhythmic stimulation. In 2015, Lucy Jung was a young industrial designer working on assistive devices for stroke victims, people with multiple sclerosis, and those with other conditions which meant they struggled with fine motor control. Her projects included a pen that used high-frequency vibrations to help Parkinson's patients write more clearly. Then she was diagnosed with a brain tumor. "I really learned what it felt like to be a patient, and that any kind of support or help can dramatically change the lives of people with long-term conditions," she says. Once she had recovered and returned to work in 2018, she picked up her research on Parkinson's with the goal to improve the lives of those with the disease. Parkinson's stems from a communication problem. Damage to neurons in the substantia nigra of the brain leads to decreased levels of dopamine and usual electrical rhythms, making it harder for signals to move between neurons. The instructions the brain is trying to send to the body struggle to get through, resulting in the characteristic tremors, rigidity, and freezing of gait seen in those with the disease. But through her prior work on the pen, Jung had identified a potential solution. In the 19th century, French neurologist Jean-Martin Charcot noticed that Parkinson's symptoms seemed to be markedly better after patients had been on a long carriage or train ride, and a subsequent research has revealed that rhythmic auditory, visual, or physical stimulation can help Parkinson's patients walk more fluidly through what's known as cueing. In 2019, Jung founded Charcot Neurotech, a Cambridge-based startup named after the French neurologist, which has developed a wearable device that promises to reduce the symptoms of Parkinson's disease. Charcot's device, the Q1, is a small plastic disc with an electric motor inside. It sits on the wearer's sternum, where it vibrates at a high frequency in a pattern that's been proven to reduce the symptoms of Parkinson's through cueing. Unlike deep brain stimulation implants, which have also been used to treat Parkinson's symptoms, the Q1 is non-invasive. It attaches to the skin using medical adhesive and inexpensive. The device is £295, which is about $375. It's already being used by more than 2,000 people in the UK, with a waiting list of almost 20,000 across 120 different countries. Charcot has raised more than $10 million in funding and grants, and now employs 38 people in the UK, South Korea, and the U.S., including Parkinson's specialists, nurses, engineers, and data analysts. The goal is to get the device approved by regulators so that it can be prescribed by doctors through the NHS or Medicaid. An app enables users to tailor the pattern of the vibration to one that works best for them, and in the future, Jung is hoping to develop a feedback system so the device automatically adjusts based on how well somebody is moving, amping up or dialing down the cueing as needed. "What we're seeing is that people tend to use the device all day," she says. "Some even use it while they're sleeping." And we push our way just a bit deeper into this issue of Wired magazine. And we see this title: Building a Better Way for Workers to Do the Right Thing. Pav Gill's startup, called Confide, aims to protect whistleblowers from retaliation and avoid them resorting to the press to seek justice. In September of 2017, Singapore-based lawyer Pav Gill took a job at Wirecard, a high-flying German payments business worth tens of billions of euros. Not long after he started, he heard from a colleague that an executive at Wirecard Asia, the region Gill was responsible for, had allegedly been teaching staff how to trick auditors into thinking the firm had money that it didn't actually have. Gill quietly began an investigation, codenamed Project Phoenix. The results were damning. Wirecard had been fudging its numbers. But when the board of directors caught wind of his work, they got very upset, said Gill. He was ordered to stand down, and his investigation came to nothing. The head of Wirecard Asia began to make Gill's life pretty horrible, he claims, yelling at him in front of colleagues and attacking the quality of his work. He was effectively forced out. But before he left, in September of 2018, he loaded a hard drive with an 85-gigabyte payload of email data tied to the investigation. It was filled, he said, with irrefutable proof of wrongdoing. Even after Gill left, Wirecard continued to haunt him. At job interviews, he felt the questions were disproportionately focused on the reason for his departure. Gill also began to suspect the firm was having both him and his mother followed. Wirecard had previously surveilled its detractors, but this was never proven in Gill's case. But he never intended to leak the email data that he'd extracted. It was meant to be a purely defensive maneuver. As a lawyer, it is ingrained that you are not meant to leak, no matter how bad the situation, said Gill. In the end, it was his mother, Sok Burkauer, who took action. Without Gill's knowledge, she had been liaising with the Financial Times, which had been investigating Wirecard for years. She had snatched the whistle and blown it on Gill's behalf. He was beside himself. But after some debate, he agreed to give the reporters the data. Why should he and his family be the ones living in fear when the truth was on their side? The first story based on Gill's data was published in January of 2019. By April of 2020, a KPMG audit had found that the lion's share of Wirecard's profits could not be verified. Later, EY, the company's original auditor, discovered that £1.9 billion was missing because the money had never existed. In another conversion, that's just a little over $2.4 million U.S. dollars. By June of 2020, Wirecard had collapsed into insolvency. Gill had played an indispensable role. 5 years after leaving, Gill says he has no regrets about blowing the whistle, but that it did lead to a great deal of hardship. So now he's trying to make the process safer. Gill is the co-founder of Confide, a startup aiming to help businesses detect and act on misconduct earlier and stop them taking revenge on the employees that report it. Confide, co-founded with Ryan Daugherty, who Gill had hired at two previous companies, has developed a software platform that allows employees to file anonymous reports. The service creates a paper trail visible to both the whistleblower and the business accused of misbehavior, but one that's stored on third parties' infrastructure to prevent it from being doctored. If a business fails to address a problem reported by a whistleblower or tries to kick it under the rug, the individual can take that paper trail to the press or to law enforcement. The existence of a tamper-proof, externally stored and anonymously created record should shield whistleblowers from the kind of harassment that Gill encountered, he argues. A second-order effect, says Gill, might be to normalize reporting misconduct and thereby recast the act of whistleblowing. It's partly an issue of terminology. Blowing the whistle implies a winging or complaining. But a standardized process for reporting could help to change the impression that whistleblowing is a form of biting the hand that feeds. Existing reporting platforms such as EQS and Navex have tended to focus on large organizations in the financial services industry, says Gill, whereas Confide will look further afield to sectors including healthcare, mining, and air travel, in which doing the wrong thing can have life-or-death consequences. Confide charges businesses an annual fee to use the platform, with extras if they want to outsource the handling and processing of reports. When Wired interviewed Gill in the fall of 2023, a basic version of Confide was due to launch in December of 2023, to coincide with new EU rules that require businesses to give employees simple channels for reporting wrongdoing. More features were set to follow in early 2024. In the Wirecard case, the decision to report misconduct to the press put a stop to the fraud. But Gill's ambition is for Confide to guide people down a different path. The press is extremely powerful, he says, but should only be used as a last resort once somebody has lost faith that a corporation will do the right thing. We're not trying to solve the problem of crime, Gill said. It's about giving businesses a chance to correct their behavior and protecting those that report it. Every now and then, I ask myself why it had to be me that exposed Wirecard, says Gill. He's still scarred by the experience, but He hopes that in Confide he's created something that will save others from feeling the same way by preventing the whistleblower from ever needing to go public. The end goal, Gill says, is to stop companies becoming Wirecard 2.0. And moving along once again, we see this article titled, Tale as Old as Time. Was Bobby truly the world's longest-lived dog? Or is he just another casualty of big kibble? On October 21st of 2023, Bobby the dog died. At 31 years and 163 days, he was old. So old, in fact, that 8 months earlier, Bobby had been crowned the oldest dog ever by Guinness World Records. But shortly after Bobby's death, experts started raising questions about the Portuguese Mastiff's advanced years. Not one of my veterinary colleagues believed Bobby was actually 31 years old, veterinarian Danny Chambers told The Guardian. For the Guinness Book of Records to maintain their credibility and authority in the eyes of the veterinary profession, they need to publish some irrefutable evidence. Someone needed to find the truth. That someone, as it turned out, was me. For more than 60 years, Guinness World Records has cataloged the stinkiest flowers, the widest mouths, and largest chicken nuggets. It had receipts for the world's oldest horses, cats, llamas in captivity, and customer complaints. Dating the world's oldest dog would be child's play. We're aware of the questions surrounding the legitimacy of the record and are reviewing them, wrote Alina Polianskaya, a public relations executive at Guinness World Records, in response to my first email. I sent a second email asking what this review process might involve. I'll come back to you when we have further info to share, Polianskaya replied. In response to my third email, she wrote, We won't have anything further to share until the review has concluded. Polianskaya did not respond to my fourth. Luckily, Guinness left a trail. In its February of 2023 post announcing Bobby as the world's oldest living dog, it mentioned that Bobby's age had been verified by SIAC, a Portuguese government database for the registration of cats, dogs, and ferrets. We're able to confirm that indeed a dog named Bobby was registered with SIAC on the 3rd of July, 2022. Eurico Cabral, a coordinator at SIAC, told me, before dropping a bombshell. At the time, the animal's holder declared that it had been born in 1992, but we have no registration or data that can confirm or deny this statement, he wrote. Now, this was intriguing. The Guinness Post claimed that SIAC had verified Bobby's age, but all the agency had was the word of Bobby's owner. Cabral had blown the case wide open. It was time to bring in the big dogs. Enico Cabinhi, an expert in dog longevity at Eötvös Loránd University in Hungary, says accurately aging dogs is extremely difficult. Records can be unreliable, and it's tricky to estimate based on physical appearance alone. Still, we have some pretty good data on how long most dogs live. Among 12,039 dogs buried or cremated in Tokyo between 2012 and 2015, mutts tended to have a higher life expectancy than purebreds, at 15.1 years on average. One dog in the Japanese data lived to age 25. In a data set of 30,563 dogs that died between 2016 and 2020 in the UK, The average across breeds was 11.2 years. Only 23 were older than 20 when they crossed the Rainbow Bridge. Cobinyi has studied two ultra-long-lived Hungarian dogs, one aged 22 and the other 27. In both cases, the dogs' ages were vouched for by adults who had known them since their birth. And like Bobby, the Hungarian dogs roamed freely and had plenty of contact with other dogs and humans, good indicators of a healthy life. One thing about Bobby raised her suspicions, though. From the photographs she had seen, Bobby seemed to be overweight. Rotund dogs rarely make it to extremely old ages, she said. I had another question for Cobinyi. In its article about Bobby, Guinness had posted photos of the dog when he was much younger. In those photos, the pattern of Bobby's fur seemed to differ from that of the older Bobby. Could a dog's coat shift over time? Cobinyi suggested I consult an expert on dog coat color. It is true that I'm considered an expert on dog coat color, Sheila Schmutz, an emeritus professor of animal and poultry science at the University of Saskatchewan in Canada, told me, at least in terms of genetics. I sent Schmutz photos of Bobby taken in 1999, 2016, and 2022. Was this the same dog? I asked. Well, it's absolutely not clear, she wrote. For certainty, I turned to Karen Becker, a veterinarian and co-author of The Forever Dog, Surprising New Science to Help Your Canine Companion Live Longer, Healthier, and Longer. In several articles, Becker was credited as the person who broke the news of Bobby's death, in a post on her Facebook page. I sent Becker a message through her website. Becker, it turned out, was away lecturing, but I did get a response from her administrative assistant, Dana Adams, who was not impressed with the Guardian article casting doubt on Bobby's longevity. The lobby organization waited until the poor little guy's cremation day to raise questions about additional testing, Adams wrote. Wait, what? A lobby organization? I pressed her for more details. Well, those of us in the pet space know it never goes well when you threaten a multi-billion-dollar empire, Adams wrote to me. Bobby's owner, a man named Lionel, had fed his pooch a home-cooked diet, she said, which made Bobby's longevity a threat to the pet food industry. She attached a screenshot of the world's top 10 pet food manufacturers. I asked the top three, Mars, Nestle, and Hill's, whether they were involved in a conspiracy to undermine the world's oldest ever dog. Mars and Nestle didn't respond. Melissa Chestnut, director of global communications at Hill's, said it had no involvement with this effort. So, the government authority in Portugal that was supposed to have verified Bobby's age has no data about the dog's birth date. Guinness World Records is staying tight-lipped until its investigation is complete. Dog aging experts aren't totally convinced that we have enough evidence to verify Bobby's age. Other people think, with no evidence, that it might all be a ruse by the pet food industry to shift more kibble. The one person who could clear all this up, Bobby's owner, hasn't responded. For a brief moment, I consider whether the previous holder of the world's oldest living dog title, Spike the Chihuahua, aged 24 in November of 2023, might be orchestrating a campaign to reclaim his title. With Bobby out of the way, were other aged canines lining up to take his crown? Perhaps the greatest mysteries, Loch Ness, the abominable snowman, Ron DeSantis's shoes, must always go unanswered. And next up in this issue of Wired, the fight against climate change starts in our cities. Cities and mayors are the strongest political forces fighting climate change, argued London's Mayor Sadiq Khan in a fireside chat at Wired Impact 2023. He quoted former Denver Mayor Wellington Webb, "The 19th century was a century of empires. The 20th century was a century of nation states. The 21st century will be a century of cities," as he told the room that while global emissions will go up 14% by 2030, in cities in the urban C40 network they will fall by more than 50%. "We're trying to address the challenges, but also channel it to an opportunity," he said. "We want to develop technology, make sure we get green finance, and create the jobs that we need to solve the problems." He explained his journey toward policies to reduce air pollution, including the controversial ultra-low emission zone, established by his predecessor but extended by Khan this year. In 2014, he ran the London Marathon. A few months later, he was shocked to discover how training on London's streets had given him asthma, triggered by the nitrogen oxide in exhaust fumes. "Doing something I love in the city I love, I'd become sick," he told the room. Nitrogen oxide leads to around 34,000 premature deaths in the UK and 4,000 in London every year. As an example of this in action, Khan cited the case of 9-year-old Londoner Ella Kissi Debras, who died in 2013 from an acute asthma attack and became the first person in the world to have air pollution listed as a cause of death on her death certificate. "If we were here in the 1950s, you could see the gray smog, but you can't see this pollution," he explained. Measuring air quality was crucial, then rolling out ULEZ to improve it was the first step in making a change. "Within a year, we saw a reduction in air pollution by almost 50%, and a third fewer children being admitted to the hospital," he explained. London now has the biggest clean air zone in the world. Although environmental policies are now part of the culture war, and ULEZ will be a focus in the UK's next general election. "People with genuine concerns are being used by populist politicians across the globe," he argued, warning the room that AI deepfakes would be part of this, having had fake videos of himself distributed online, quoting things he'd never said. "Legislation needs to catch up with technology, and we ought to already be at the design phase of that legislation and regulation." Khan admitted that in this instance, politicians needed to take some of the blame. "We have failed to understand our role as educators," he explained. "We have to combine our values with the evidence and find solutions. It's difficult to do in a tweet, but we can do it and we can take people with us." "Cities are the solution," he argued, "because we're far more nimble, whereas governments, presidents, and prime ministers take some time. In most cities, you tend to get people who are more diverse, younger, well-educated, so they follow the evidence. Mayors are close to the people we serve, so we can move faster." On the cover of this issue of Wired magazine is a picture of Xu Zi Chu, the CEO of TikTok. Let's head into the article that's featured in this edition about him. It's entitled "The Algorithmic Authenticity of Xu Zi Chu." The CEO of the world's most influential social media company likes tacos, Sheryl Crow, and Diablo 4. Is he for real or a really good politician? Before I sit down to talk to TikTok CEO Xu Zi Chu, he apologizes for the noise. The evening's guests have been doing sporadic sound checks all day. Peso Pluma running through his opening number. Offset ad-libbing over a backing track. I passed by throngs of One Direction fans to get into the park. Niall Horan for $25. That's a solid deal. This isn't where I imagined I'd be talking to the head of the most influential social media app on the planet, but the only way I could get on Chu's calendar was by meeting him at TikTok's first-ever music festival, a sold-out two-stage program at the Cubs training facility in Mesa, Arizona. The location makes no sense until you realize that for TikTok, location doesn't really matter. Only numbers do. The whole festival will be streamed exclusively on the app, for free, and highlights would later air on Disney Plus and Hulu. It's the digits on the top left of everyone's phone screen tonight that will be the ultimate metric of success or failure for this event. I'm also here because it seems like Chu never really got to introduce himself on his own terms. When he stepped in as TikTok's CEO in mid-2021, there was little fanfare. The official at TikTok account didn't even make a TikTok about it. Instead, Chu's introduction to the wider public took place during a barrage of questions at a congressional hearing in Washington, D.C. last March. It was a circus, a TikTok employee tells me, speaking under condition of anonymity. They didn't even let him talk. They had the attitude of, you're a Chinese spy and we're going to beat the shit out of you. This is a bit over the top, but the sentiment can't be wholly dismissed. Three things can simultaneously be true. First, that China's government openly watches its citizens, and an app with origins there will naturally raise a red flag in many countries, especially in the U.S., after parent company ByteDance was caught tracking journalists there in 2022. Second, that people have been handing over increasing amounts of data for years, including to companies like Uber and Facebook, both of which have also reportedly tracked journalists. And any company collecting so much user data should be heavily scrutinized. And third, that thinly veiled anti-Chinese xenophobia has become a reliable part of the U.S. political playbook. TikTok has made a show of addressing the first two issues. During the hearings, anyone listening heard Chu promise to move all of its U.S. data to a Texas-based server. The company has less control over the third issue. It is hard to imagine that the app will ever be non-Chinese enough for, say, the governor of Montana, whose reason for banning TikTok in the state was to protect Montanans' personal and private data from the Chinese Communist Party. A federal judge has since temporarily blocked the ban. Chu seems to have the right temperament to keep TikTok in various governments' good graces. He gives off none of the abrasive tech bro energy of his peers, instead exuding the folksy persona of someone perpetually running for town mayor. A handsome, charming man who seems genuinely curious about everyone he meets. Savvy enough to know who evening headliner Cardi B is, but not quite savvy enough to know that he was supposed to remove the white-based stitches from his blazer before wearing it to the event. He's quick to steer any potentially dicey conversation to a story of a user he met in whatever locale suits the current situation, deftly rattling off how many followers one user or another gained overnight, how many items were sold after a shop went viral. He remembers faces and names, and he visits small businesses. He, or his comms team, even arranged for tacos from AZ Taco King, a local TikTok success story, to be conveniently delivered during our interview. When I asked Chu who he looked up to as a kid, he doesn't name music or sports stars, but Lee Kuan Yew, the founding prime minister of Chu's home, Singapore. Lee is widely credited with lifting the country from poverty into an economic powerhouse over his 31-year tenure. He has also been called a benevolent dictator. He'd be on an obvious North Star for a certain sort of politician, less so for the head of a social media company that got started with selfie dance videos. But let's be clear. TikTok is no longer in competition with other social media companies, especially if your metric of success is immersion. It outclasses every other app in this regard. X is chasing away advertisers. TikTok integrates them. Meta has promised a metaverse where we create, work, shop, and play. With TikTok, it's already here. No headset required. YouTube is a good place to post videos, but not to make them. TikTok not only lets you post videos, but its in-house editing app rivals expensive pro-level software. An entire culture is rising up of users to whom it doesn't occur to leave the app for, well, anything. TikTok's true competition, then, is the politics of each territory in which it operates. And Chu's newest strategy seems to be taking his stump speech on the road, virtually and IRL. BitDance is spending millions on lobbying, yes, but Chu is also ramping up his charm offensive, making TikToks on his own account, at shu.time. Encouraging users to tell everyone about how much they love the app. I should mention that I was an early user of the app, downloading it right after it became available. I have covered TikTokers who were using the app for positive impact, and I know people whose lives changed forever after a single post, whether an in-joke about local weather or humanizing stories about incarcerated people. Some of these same users are also say that being TikTok famous has made them anxious, that they feel obligated to make the same kind of videos over and over, lest the algorithm punish them. This also makes me think about how, while Chu has been pressed on TikTok's security practices, he hasn't had much to say about how dependent global pop culture has become on the app. That's something we should think about as TikTok continues to extend its influence over how we experience culture, including food, music, and fashion. TikTok has irreversibly bent our culture's trajectory, but that doesn't guarantee it'll be around to reap the benefits. India banned the app long ago, and it's under growing scrutiny in a handful of other countries. It has walked the political tightrope this far, but any bad PR could knock it off. Maybe that's why TikTok's chief comms officer, who used to work in U.S. politics herself, made a show of recording my conversation with Chu on her phone. The overprotectiveness isn't surprising, of course. TikTok knows Chu can't play the game in quite the same way many of his Silicon Valley counterparts do. Taunting the media, for example, will always be off-limits for him. Instead, he has chosen a gentler kind of evangelism, telling people that things really are nicer in his walled garden, if only they'd give the app a chance, and that the garden will be even nicer if we all produce more content. And we move along to another article in this issue. Its title says, "The Lair Inside Mark Zuckerberg's Top Secret Hawaiian Compound." Meta's CEO is building a sprawling $200 million private complex on Kauai, complete with plans for a huge underground bunker. A Wired investigation reveals the true scale of the project and its impact on the local community. Off the two-lane highway that winds along the northeast side of the Hawaiian island of Kauai, on a quiet stretch of ranch land between the tourist hubs of Kapaia and Hanalei, an enormous secret construction project is underway. A 6-foot wall blocks the view from a nearby road fronting the project, where cars slow to try to catch a glimpse of what's behind it. Security guards stand watch at an entrance gate and patrol the surrounding beaches on ATVs. Pickup trucks roll in and out, hauling building materials and transporting hundreds of workers. Nobody working on this project is allowed to talk about what they're building. Almost anyone who passes compound security, from carpenters to electricians to painters to security guards, is bound by a strict non-disclosure agreement, according to several workers involved in the project. And they say these agreements aren't a formality. Multiple workers claim they saw or heard about colleagues removed from the project for posting about it on social media. Different construction crews within the site are assigned to separate projects, and workers are forbidden from talking with other crews about their work, according to sources. "It's Fight Club. We don't talk about Fight Club," says David, one former contract employee. Wired has agreed to withhold his real name because he was not authorized to speak to the press. "Anything posted from here, they get wind of it right away." Another former site worker, who we will call John, said he was told that another member of his construction company was fired for allegedly sharing a picture of the project on Snapchat. He's heard very similar stories from other crews. John says the very strict enforcement of NDAs has made workers on site unwilling to take the chance to get caught even taking a picture. The project is so huge that a not insignificant share of the island is bound by the NDA. But everyone here knows who is behind it. Mark Zuckerberg, CEO of Meta, who bought the land in a series of deals beginning in August of 2014. Interviews with several people associated with the project, along with public records and court documents seen by Wired, suggested that since then the planning and construction of the roughly 1,400-acre compound has been shrouded in secrecy. The property, known as Kulau Ranch, will, according to a planning documents, include a 5,000-square-foot underground shelter, have its own energy and food supplies, and, when coupled with land purchase prices, will cost in excess of $270 million. According to evidence reviewed by Wired, the project has relied on legal maneuvering and political networking, and at times, sources believe, it has shown disregard for the local public. All the while, Zuckerberg and his wife Priscilla Chan continue to build one of the most expensive properties in the world. According to sources and planning documents reviewed by Wired, the compound will be self-sufficient with its own water tank, 55 feet in diameter and 18 feet tall, along with a pump system. A variety of food is already produced across its 1,400 acres through ranching and agriculture. Brandy Hoffain Barr, spokesperson for Mark Zuckerberg and Priscilla Chan, declined to comment on the size or bunker-like qualities of the project. The cost rivals that of the largest private personal construction projects in human history. Building permits put the price tag for the main construction at around $100 million, in addition to $170 million in land purchases, but this is likely an underestimate. Building costs on the remote island are still higher than pre-pandemic levels. According to Alan Pericini, a local journalist, The focus on managing the flow of information around the compound has included reprimanding the local press for critical coverage. Throughout 2017, Parrucchini had been requesting permits in an effort to learn what Zuckerberg was building on Kauai. He'd also recently written an opinion piece in the local newspaper, The Garden Island, that was critical of Zuckerberg, ending with a call for residents to tell Zuckerberg that abusing his stewardship of public beaches as if we are just another batch of Facebook victims is unacceptable.